immediately let out a startled grunt and started shaking and sinking toward the ground.
"It weighs a ton," she said. "Help!"
Martin dove forward to help her carry her burden, but he could not see her burden and ended up jamming his fingers on the void, which caused him to yelp in pain and surprise. The force of Martin striking the invisible mass caused Gwen to lose control of it. It rolled out of her hands, away from Martin. Gwen had not seen Roy lurching toward her on the other side to try to help her with her load. Because her load was invisible, she did not see it land directly on Roy's foot with an audible thud. Roy yelled and cursed and reached down with both hands and pushed whatever it was off his foot. While Roy checked for broken toes and Martin checked for broken fingers, Britt went to the spot where she estimated that a heavy, round object would stop rolling. She carefully explored the area with her foot until she found what she was looking for. She crouched down, felt the contours of the object, and when she was convinced that she knew where it was and what shape it was, Britt sat on it. She seemed to hover in an impossible squatting position.
"Okay," Britt thought. "We've got something invisible that we're going to have to transport who knows how far. We have to do something to make it visible. Think, Britt. What is the most visible thing you know? Something you can't miss. Something obnoxiously obvious."
Britt thought for a moment before saying,
"Martin, can I borrow your robe?"
17. After more hiking through what the wizards had dubbed Falling Wolf Forest, the path led them to a town. A smattering of nearly identical buildings was the backdrop for a set of nearly identical peasants doing obviously repetitive things. A man whittled. A woman kneaded dough. A child ran in a circle for no apparent reason. It was all clearly designed to be just convincing enough to be boring. A stack of damp hay here. A chicken darting across the street there. A dilapidated ox cart tucked between two buildings. The wizard's eyes were drawn to the only interesting thing in the town. A blacksmith shop set in the center of the village, like a jewel in a setting. It wasn't a workshop so much as a large open pen with a rough awning overhead and a metal sign out front that said, "Ye Old Town Smithy." Beyond that, Philip couldn't make out any detail, just motion, flame, and rhythmic clanking noises. It was Philip's turn to drag the sledge, and he was good and tired of it. He didn't really mind so much, though, because he was also tired of not pulling the sledge at this point, so it made little difference. Philip chose not to slow down and lose momentum. He knew that the next step in the quest was to have the cursed chunk of ore he was dragging fashioned into some sort of weapon, so he assumed that the blacksmith shop was his destination. He leaned forward, the taut rope wrapped over his shoulder, resting on his full-length fur vest. The collar stood high, warming his ears. The sleeves had long since fallen away, and now were wrapped around his forearms like leg warmers on a dancer on the cover of a jazzercise video. Jimmy approached the woman who was endlessly kneading a large lump of bread dough and asked,
"Pardon me, can you tell me, is this the town called Beaumore?"
Jimmy held no illusions about having a real conversation or about his courtesy even being noticed. He was polite out of habit. As with all of Todd's artificial creations, her response almost fit the question, but not quite.
"How can ye not know where ye are? This be the town of Beaumore."
Jimmy said, "Right, thanks," and moved on. They reached the blacksmith shop and left the sledge and its heavy cargo out front. They weren't particularly worried that anyone would try to steal it. Knowing how difficult it had been to get here, they would have enjoyed watching someone try. Under the awning, there was a smoking black pile of bricks with a fiery hole in the front, like a New York City pizza oven, only much hotter and slightly dirtier. All around, laid out on metal racks, there were metal implements, all clearly used to form more metal implements. Every vertical surface was covered with handmade hasps, hinges, nails, hooks, and horseshoes. In the center of the room, a tall man, with arms thicker than a normal man's legs, was using tongs and brute force to bend a glowing metal bar. Tyler took the lead in interacting with the blacksmith. He was over any pretense at playing along with the fantasy of this quest. They were not knights performing tasks to fulfill some prophecy. They were mice trapped in a poorly made maze, trying to find their way out as efficiently as possible. Pretending that this blacksmith was anything other than a pre-programmed puppet was a waste of time at best, and a source of entertainment for their tormentor at worst. The blacksmith stopped hammering the glowing metal, and turned his soot-covered face to look at Tyler.
"Greetings, stranger,"
the blacksmith said.
"How does this day find you?"
Tyler said, "We got the rock," and pointed over his shoulder toward the sledge that waited out front. The blacksmith put down his soot-encrusted tools and walked to a soot-encrusted basin, which seemed to be full of a mixture of equal parts water and soot. He washed his hands and dried them on a soot-black towel, saying,
"I am Inchgoer, skilled blacksmith and crafter of fine weapons."
Tyler said, "We got the rock." The blacksmith nodded as if listening intently, then said,
"Aye, 'tis a long journey to be sure. I'm certain you didn't come all this way without good reason."
Tyler said,
"We got the rock."
The blacksmith raised his eyebrows.
"I see. You've come to the right place, but sadly, I cannot help you."
Tyler rolled his eyes and made the motion of a yakking mouth to Gary, then repeated, "We got the rock!"
"I know all about the prophecy,"
the blacksmith explained.
"But to make the weapon you need, I require certain raw materials. Materials that have not been available for quite some time, I'm afraid."
Tyler glanced back at Philip, who chuckled lightly. Tyler turned with a flourish, motioned toward the sledge with much fluttering of hands, bowed deeply, and said,
"We got the rock."
Inchgoer dropped the soot-soaked towel on the soot-covered floor and walked slowly past the wizards to the front of the shop. He gazed down in amazement at the dull gray lump of stone they had dragged all the way from the mine.
"You have it,"
he said.
"You managed to procure the Diluine. I cannot believe it."
Gary said,
"We got the rock."
"I can handle this, Gary,"
Tyler said. Inchgoer spread his massive arms wide, turned to face the wizards, and said,
"Gentlemen, I will make you your weapon."
He stood there, almost motionless, cycling through some small subroutine designed to make him seem less statue-like while he waited for the next bit of stimulus to which he would respond. Tyler looked back at the others, then looked at the cheerful, benevolent look on Inchgoer's face. Tyler sighed.
"What's the catch?"
Inchgoer laughed and seized Tyler by the shoulders, shaking him slightly.
"We will need bricks. Lots of bricks, my friends. Come with me. There are wheelbarrows out back."
Sometime later, and several hundred yards away, the wizard stood beside a massive clay pit. They had found a seemingly endless row of recently sun-dried bricks that were just irregular enough to make it painfully obvious that Todd had only created a few of them, then endlessly replicated those. Much like Chicken McNuggets, the slight variations only made them seem more identical.
"Fantastic," Philip said. "Todd's going to try to work us to death."
Gary said, "Oh, I don't know. This might not be so bad. A little physical activity might be nice for a change."
"Nice for a change?" Philip asked. "Doesn't hiking count as physical activity? Because it seems to me that's all we do anymore."
"That's my point," Gary said, stretching his back, limbering up. "We've been doing the same things over and over. Maybe this'll break up the monotony."
"Ah, I see,"
Philip said.
"Stacking and hauling bricks seems like a source of variety and mental stimulation to you."
"At least it'll work the upper body,"
Gary said, stretching his hamstrings.
"We haven't really been doing all that much with our arms."
Tyler asked,
"What about sledge dragging?"
"And wolf stabbing?" Jimmy added.
Yeah, I see your point. Gary allowed. But you have to admit, we've been working the same muscle groups over and over. This'll give us a chance to hit some new ones. See my point?
The other three made eye contact for a moment, silently reaching a consensus. Then, Philip said,
No, we don't.
Gary exhaled.
Look, I'm just trying to keep a positive attitude. Is that okay with you?
Again, they silently took a vote. Again, Philip spoke for the group.
No, it isn't.
They piled as many bricks as they dared into the two wheelbarrows, and, as was now their custom, took turns maneuvering them back to Inchgower's shop. Inchgower was waiting for them to arrive. He rubbed his hands together excitedly, generating a small cloud of soot in the process.
Good work. Well done. You can unload them right here.
Inchgower pointed to a specific bare patch of ground and made it clear that he would not move again until all the bricks were unloaded. No sooner had Jimmy placed the final brick on the stack than Inchgower sprang back to life, bustling around his shop, gathering certain tools he would need, and clearing workspace in the middle of the floor. Inchgower rummaged through his tool rack, and when he turned to them, he had four shovels that had seemed to appear from nowhere. He said,
Now, we're ready for the clay.
Later, they returned from the clay pits, carrying well-used shovels and fully loaded wheelbarrows. Their arms, like their tools, were coated up to their shoulders in a thin gray coat of cracking clay.
This stuff's gonna take forever to wash off, Tyler complained.
Nah, Gary reassured him. I bet it'll dry and most of it'll crack off on its own. In the meantime, we'll all look like the thing. And that's always cool.
Yeah, Tyler said. That's what the thing was famous for. Looking cool.
They hauled the wheelbarrows full of wet clay to the rear of Inchgower's shop. Predictably, Inchgower was waiting for them with vague praise and specific instructions. They unloaded the clay in a sullen, exhausted manner, but they did it all the same. Inchgower stood almost motionless, pointing at the spot where they were piling the wet clay, waiting for them to finish. Jimmy was just about to gather the last shovelful from the wheelbarrow when he stopped. The others looked on, puzzled.
Come on, Philip said. Let's get this over with.
No, Jimmy said. Let's not get this over with.
He put down his shovel and sat in the shade for a moment. It did not take long for the others to get the idea. They rested for a while, ate some wolf jerky, explored the town a bit, and got a good night's sleep under the awning that formed the roof of Inchgower's shop. All the while, Inchgower stood silently, pointing to the clay pile, waiting for them to complete their task. When they were good and ready, they moved the last shovel of clay.
Well done, lads! Inchgower said. Now we can start making things.
Inchgower led them from the rear of his workshop to a spot out front and said,
We'll start by making a pile of bricks. Bring in the bricks, and I'll tell you how they should be stacked.
Tyler asked, Why can't we just stack them behind the shop where they already are? And already in a stack, for that matter.
He hadn't expected a real answer. But when Inchgower said,
There's a good lad.
It was particularly unsatisfying. Philip reminded him of the real answer.
Because Todd designed this whole thing to irritate us, remember? He knows we didn't become wizards or get into computers in the first place because we love manual labor.
The wizards took their time, but they did as they were told. Each time they'd return from out back with an armload of bricks, Inchgower would talk them through the process of stacking them. Soon they had a solid square base, 3 feet long and 3 feet wide, with the beginnings of walls that had small holes along the base.
Splendid!
Inchgower said.
Now, one of you will bring some of the clay to my work table, and the rest of you will continue building the walls. You should be able to keep going without instructions from here.
Jimmy, Gary, and Philip spent a good long time stacking the heavy bricks, building up the walls of whatever they were building. Inchgower instructed Tyler, most likely because he was standing closest to Inchgower at the time, to bring him some clay and place it on a work table. When the clay was on the table, Inchgower said,
"More clay, please."
After several repetitions of this cycle, Inchgower thanked Tyler, then got to work. Work, in this case, meant moving his hands in a vague, repetitive manner, so as to give the impression that something was getting accomplished without ever actually touching the clay. After a few seconds of this, the heap of clay disappeared and was replaced by some sort of vessel, like a crude pot made of soft clay, about 8 inches across and a foot tall, with thick walls.
"If Todd can have all this crap done automatically," Gary asked, "why are we having to do any of this?"
Philip said,
"To go into detail about the things the blacksmith has to do, the skilled labor, that would be extra work for Todd, so he glosses over it. The stuff that's extra work for us to do, the grunt labor, that's easy for him to just order us to do. So we're getting all that in exquisite detail."
When the brick structure was an almost perfect 3-foot cube, Inchgower stopped construction. He put the pot he'd made and a lid he'd quickly slapped together for it in his forge fire and closed the metal door.
"We'll just let that harden for a while."
He turned his back to them, poking around his tool rack. When he turned back around, he had 4 large hand scoops.
"In the meantime, lads, we'll be needing charcoal, and plenty of it."
Hours later, they returned from the surprisingly distant bonfire pit, dyed pitch black with coal dust, and pushing 3 wheelbarrows piled high with chunks of charcoal. They unloaded the charcoal, triggering Inchgower to tell them to pack clay around the walls of the cube, but to leave the holes in the cube's bottom accessible. Their arms had no strength left, so packing the wet clay onto the cube seemed to take forever. Their hands were caked with sweat, dust, clay, and soot, and they were too exhausted to care. Inchgower removed the crude cylindrical pot from his forge and told the wizards to get a good night's sleep.
"For tomorrow, you do battle."
Philip said,
"Yep, fair enough,"
as he settled into his bedroll. After the half second his brain needed to process what he'd heard, he sat bolt upright and asked,
"Wait, what? Do battle? We're not here to fight anything. We're here to make a weapon."
Inchgower nodded in inappropriate agreement.
"In order to complete my work, I will need a bone from a wretched beast known to the villagers as Strathyla. He comes once a fortnight to eat a villager. We have been quite powerless to stop it. You will slay the monster for us. I will consider that my payment for all of my work."
Gary asked,
"Your work? You've been working?"
But, being essentially a recording, Inchgower ignored him.
"When you have killed Strathyla, bring me one of the beast's bones so I can channel its strength into your weapon."
Inchgower smiled like a doctor, telling a new father that he has a healthy baby.
"Sleep well, for as fortune has it, Strathyla attacks tomorrow."
The wizards reacted like a new father who had expected the doctor to tell him that his wife had appendicitis. 18. The next morning, shortly after dawn, Philip, Jimmy, Gary, and Tyler were lined up across the road through Bowmore like gunslingers, waiting for a long-overdue showdown. Except that they had swords and had no idea who or what they'd be fighting. The artificial villagers were locked into some sort of acting terrified subroutine. They would peek out of the windows of the buildings, then emerge to sprint across the street, darting into a building on the other side of the street so they could peek out different windows.
"What do you think it'll be?"
Gary asked anyone who'd answer. Philip said,
"Something with bones. That's all we know."
Gary considered this.
"Well, that narrows it down a bit."
"Not really,"
Philip said.
"Sure it does," Gary explained. "At least we know we won't be fighting a giant slug. Well, that's good, at least."
Giant slug? That's what you're worried about, a giant slug?
Gary rolled his eyes.
Philip, do you want to fight a giant slug?
No. You put it that way, I have to admit I don't want to fight a giant slug.
Gary said.
Good. Apology accepted.
Philip started to react, but he saw both Jimmy and Tyler subtly shaking their heads and decided they were right. They waited. An old lady ran across the street. The wind picked up. A bird whistled in the distance. A young boy ran across the street. The wind gust died away. Somewhere nearby, a cat hissed. The old lady ran back across the street to where she started. A seam ripped open in the ground, and a dark blur shot out, grabbing the old lady by the leg and dragging her underground before the seam reclosed. They all looked at each other, then back at the empty patch of ground.
"Do you think that was it?" Gary asked.
The seam reopened, more slowly this time, and with a terrible rumbling noise. From their point of view, the fissure in the ground looked like a black line that extended in opposite directions, curving away from the men and eventually re-emerging dozens of feet away. The broad, flat surface they had thought was solid ground lifted and tilted back. Beneath, supporting the road's weight, there was some sort of dark, movable mass. For what seemed like a long time, but was probably less than 5 seconds, Philip struggled to make sense of what he was seeing. It looked like two large, broken umbrellas were fighting. Soon, his brain figured out what he was looking at, and he could not unrecognize it, no matter how badly he wanted to. The spider was a little over 10 feet tall and at least 30 feet across, with long, spindly legs and a body covered with thick black fur. It cast away the roof of its burrow as easily as a man in a sauna casts off his towel, and, like the other men in the sauna, the wizards instantly wished it hadn't. Philip's mind was paralyzed with fear. Jimmy and Gary seemed equally speechless. Tyler was suffering no such problem.
A giant spider! Seriously? Damn you, Todd, you idiot! Just when I think I couldn't respect you less, you go and pull this!
The spider stopped moving, which would have been comforting if everything else, the villagers, the trees, the wind, everything, hadn't stopped as well. Silently, Todd's chat box blinked open in front of the spider, almost as if his unshaven face were the spider's. Todd smirked down at them and said,
"What's the matter, Tyler? Don't like spiders?"
"I got no problem with spiders, but I hate a cliché. Giant spiders are in everything. They've been done to death. If this is the best you could do, you shouldn't have bothered."
Todd looked genuinely confused and more than a little hurt.
"But it's a trapdoor spider. Every time you see a giant spider, it's spinning a giant web. Nobody's done a giant trapdoor spider. That's a new idea."
"Just because nobody's done it doesn't mean it's a new idea. It might just mean that it's a bad idea,"
Tyler explained.
"Think about it. The blacksmith said that the monster comes every 2 weeks. Well, if it's a trapdoor spider, that means it's here, hiding down there in his hole all the time."
Todd frowned.
"I didn't think about that."
"You didn't think at all. You needed a monster. Your brain spit out the words big honking spider, and you called it good. You gave no thought to the fact that it came to you so quickly because you've seen it 1,000 times.
"Well, it's only been used so many times because it works so well,"
Todd said. Tyler replied,
"I got 2 things to say about that. One, just because a giant spider might work in this case doesn't mean that something original wouldn't work as well or better. 2, a spider doesn't work in this case. Not at all, because spiders don't have bones. We're supposed to bring back the monster's bones. You've given us a monster that has an exoskeleton. That's a hard outer shell, which means no bones."
Todd smirked and shook his head.
"What about octopuses, They don't have hard shells."
Tyler asked,
"So what? Octopuses aren't spiders?"
"Yeah, they are. They're the spiders of the sea."
"No, they aren't."
"Huh? What?"
Todd sputtered.
"How are octopuses not spiders?"
"Well,
What do you mean? How are they not spiders? They're not spiders. In the same way, you're not a spider!
Tyler shrieked.
But they've got eight legs,
Todd explained.
Octo means eight. That's why Dr. Octopus has eight robot arms.
Tyler shook his fists and sprayed saliva as he shouted,
No! Dr. Octopus did not have eight robot arms! He had his normal four human limbs and four robot limbs! That equals eight, like an octopus!
Or a spider,
Todd said, thinking.
Yes!
Because octopuses are part of the spider family.
No, they aren't! And this whole conversation is pointless anyway, because octopuses don't have bones either!
Todd said,
Eight legs, no bones, but you're sure they aren't spiders?
Jimmy cleared his throat, then said,
Actually, marine biologists will tell you that octopuses have two legs and six arms.
Tyler said,
Let me handle this, Jimmy.
Without looking back, Todd pinched the bridge of his nose and closed his eyes for a moment. Then he said,
Look, okay, you have a point. Giant spiders have been done before, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to do something new with it.
Like what?
Tyler asked.
Maybe it'll attack you in a way you aren't expecting.
It's a spider,
Tyler said flatly.
I'm pretty sure it'll involve webs and venom.
Todd smiled slyly and said,
Maybe.
It's a spider!
Tyler was yelling again.
What else can it do? Did you teach it kung fu?
Philip leaned to Gary and said,
Ooh, a spider that knows kung fu. That'd actually be quite cool, wouldn't it? I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of an eight-legged roundhouse kick.
Gary said, Nah, man, aren't you listening? Spiders have two legs and six arms.
Jimmy said,
That's octopuses.
Gary rolled his eyes.
And octopuses are the spiders of the sea. Come on, keep up, guys.
Jimmy was about to respond when he, Gary, and Philip became aware that both Tyler and Todd were staring at them.
Sorry, Jimmy said. We'll discuss this later. Please, continue bickering.
Todd struck a conciliatory tone.
Tyler, I know that you don't think much of my quest. That's fine. You're entitled to your opinion. Complain all you want. Just know that you're going to be complaining while you're completing the quest, or dying in the process. No amount of whining will get you out of it. Right now, that means fighting my giant spider. And just to remind you, the spider can, and probably will, kill you. Remember, from here on in, as per your suggestion, everything can kill you.
Todd's chat window disappeared. The wind resumed blowing. The trees resumed swaying. Strathyla, the giant spider, resumed its climb out of the massive crater it had been using as its trap. Tyler muttered,
How would it even dig such a large hole without the villagers noticing? Tyler, focus,
Philip said. Tyler said,
You're right. Okay, guys, don't let it bite you. Watch out for webs. Try to attack its eyes if its head gets close. Otherwise, go for the leg joints. Those are its weak spots.
How do you know?
Gary asked.
Because those are always the weak spots.
Philip looked at the spider, and the spots where the leg segments met did seem thin and vulnerable. The eyes are universal weak spots no matter who or what you were fighting, so Tyler's advice seemed sound. The spider was completely out in the open now. It slowly crept toward the wizards. They unsheathed their swords and readied themselves for action. As it loomed over them, Tyler said,
If it does kung fu, I'm gonna be so pissed.
The spider planted all 8 feet and leaned back, holding its body close to the ground as if preparing to leap forward, then froze. The wizards held their ground, watching for the slightest movement. The spider didn't seem to be in any hurry to move. The fur on its carapace ruffled and fluttered in the breeze. The thick black fur swayed, undulating like wheat in a field.
That's odd, Philip thought. It's not that windy. The breeze must be stronger over there.
As they watched, the fur seemed to lengthen, growing spikier, like a time-lapse film in an ad for the Chia Pet. The fur seemed to spread up the spider's immense legs. It streamed off the spider's body onto its legs. Only as the fur started to reach the ground did they see that it was never fur at all, just the legs of thousands of smaller spiders. They spread from the 8 points where they made contact with the ground, swelling into a writhing black pool of horror. The smaller spiders looked tiny, gathered around the feet of Strathyla, but each one was about the size of a kitten, which would have been fine if they had been kittens, but they weren't. They were spiders, and as such, they had barely started advancing on the wizards before the wizards did the logical thing, which was to run in 4 separate directions, screaming 4 different random strings of curse words. Gary reached the front door of the nearest hovel. He pushed, then pulled on the door with all of his strength, but it didn't budge. He turned around, pressing his back to the immovable door, and saw that the mass of smaller spiders had broken into 4 streams, each one chasing a wizard. Philip had tried the door of a cottage across the street with the same amount of success as Gary. Jimmy was climbing a tree. Tyler had run halfway back to the blacksmith shop before stopping and turning to survey the situation. Gary called out, "Tyler! Does this always happen?" Todd's voice filled the air.
"Yeah, Tyler. Does it?"
"Shut up,"
Tyler said.
"Both of you."
Tyler instantly realized both that stopping was a mistake and that it was too late to undo the damage. The spiders were faster than he was and had nearly reached him by the time he'd stopped. He lurched to the left and then to the right, but the skittering mass swelled in whatever direction he moved, trying to flank him and then advancing when he moved away from them. In trying unsuccessfully to pursue him, the spiders had managed to block him in on 3 sides. He ran a few more steps away from the mass, but looking at the ground as he ran, he could see that the spiders were advancing as a group, outpacing him on each side. Within a few more steps, they had surrounded him. Tyler had no choice but to stop. He cast a desperate glance at the others, hoping they were in a position to help. Gary had climbed the facade of the hut he'd tried to enter, and was now standing on its roof, which would have been a brilliant move if spiders were bad at climbing walls. That not being the case, the spiders were advancing up the walls of the hut. Philip, uncharacteristically, was taking Gary's lead, and had just made it to the roof of a hovel across the street. He stood up, looked down at the spiders climbing the wall behind him, and said,
"Of course."
Jimmy had climbed a tree, which had worked out better in some ways, worse in others. The single, narrow tree trunk had limited how many spiders could chase him up the tree at once. It had also limited his obvious means of escape to 1, the same narrow tree trunk that was now bulging with angry spiders. Jimmy had moved out to a thick lower limb. The central mass of the tree was alive with spiders, as if the tree was covered with thick, black, wriggling foliage. The spiders ventured out onto Jimmy's limb, but stopped 3 feet short of his location. Jimmy looked down at the closest spider, confused. He looked toward Philip, stranded on his rooftop. Tyler looked to Philip's location as well, and saw that Philip was standing in the center of a circle about 6 feet wide, a circle delineated by an ever-thickening mass of spiders. Tyler looked at Gary and found that he, too, was surrounded but unharmed. Tyler realized that he probably should have been swarmed and devoured by now. He looked down. He was also standing in a clear circle. The fact that he was still alive didn't feel so much like a reprieve as a delay. He had no doubt that this was just a brief pause to let them be terrified before they were killed. Tyler drew his sword.
"Oh well," he thought. "At least the spiders aren't doing kung fu."
Tyler heard a strange, low, chittering sound come from the tangle of spiders at his feet. He looked down just in time to see a single spider spring free from the rest and fly directly toward his face. He killed it in midair with a single chop of his sword and readied himself to feel the other spiders cover him. It did not happen. Tyler looked down at the spiders and again heard the queer, low chattering, this time to his right. He spun, looked down, and saw a single spider in the group press down as if ready to leap. It sprung for Tyler's face. Tyler dispatched it as he had the first. Scowling, Tyler scanned the spiders, listening for the sound again. It was difficult over the sound of the other guys yelling, but Tyler focused on the spiders. He heard the sound, spun 180 degrees, and saw what he had both hoped and feared he would see, a single spider, surrounded by hundreds of its seemingly passive brethren, hunched down, preparing to strike alone. He dispatched it easily, then shouted to the others,
"Relax! The hack used the same stupid AI as he did for the wolves!"
"We know!"
Philip shrieked.
"Behind you! Now!"
Tyler had made it three-quarters of the way to the blacksmith shop before stopping and getting surrounded. He had pivoted and was standing with his left side toward the shop and his right toward the others. He glanced back to his right and saw Philip, Gary, and Jimmy, all stuck in high places, surrounded by kitten-sized spiders on an otherwise empty street. He spun 180 degrees just in time to see Strathyla, the building-sized spider, shooting a web his way. The sensation was like having someone dump a cooler full of Gatorade on you. Only, instead of being cold, it's sticky, and instead of meaning that you've won a game, it means that you're about to be eaten. In an instant, Tyler's legs were glued together, his left arm was cemented across his belly, and his right arm, which he'd used to shield his face, was now stuck immovably to his forehead. He wriggled, hopped, then fell over backward. The smaller spiders scattered to get out of his way, maintaining their respectful distance. None of them made the sound that signaled an imminent attack. It seemed that Strathyla had licked him, and now he belonged to her. The others watched Tyler squirming helplessly in the dirt, and Strathyla slowly advancing on her prey. Jimmy looked back to the central mass of the tree, just in time to swat down an attacking spider. The tree, save for the branch on which he was stranded, was a living mass of arachnids. There was no way to crawl through them, and even if he could, Tyler would be dead before he even made it to the trunk of the tree, let alone the ground. Another spider chittered and sprang for Jimmy's face. He cut it in half with his sword and watched as the parts fell to the ground. The empty ground, about 10 feet beneath him.
"Jimmy," he chastised himself, "I thought you were supposed to be smart."
Jimmy hung from the branch by one arm, bringing himself a few feet from the ground. He let go of the tree and hit the ground running. If he'd looked back, he'd have seen the spiders cascading out of the tree like a black, hairy waterfall, but he didn't look back. Tyler's vision was severely limited, blocked mostly by his own right arm. His field of view had been reduced to an irregular peephole formed by the crook of his elbow and the right side of his nose. He could see his body, covered with webbing, his feet gummed together beyond that, and beyond his feet, Strathyla advancing toward him. The smaller spiders parted, clearing her path to Tyler. He struggled, attempting to propel himself away from her, but squirming with all his might, he only managed to move a few inches. He chose not to give Todd the satisfaction. He thought,
"So this is it. The end."
He saw the spider slowly closing on him. He couldn't tell if it was being cautious or savoring the moment, but he didn't really think it mattered.
"Killed fighting against a tired cliché. I guess there's some satisfaction in that for a writer. Not as much as there being defeating the cliché, but you can't have everything."
Strathyla was close now. All he could see was the underside of her abdomen as she loomed over him. Tyler felt her lift him from the ground. His view of the world became a blur of blue and brown as she spun him, wrapping him with webbing. He felt nauseated. He pressed his eyes shut and braced himself. He knew in a second his vision would be completely blocked by webbing. After that, he didn't know what would come next, but he knew it wouldn't be pleasant. Would he get bitten and killed by venom? Would he suffocate, trapped like a mummy in the spider's web? Would he be left helpless to die of thirst, unable to free himself? Maybe Strathyla and the smaller spiders would simply devour him alive. What happened was that he fell to the ground, landing square on his back. Tyler opened his eyes. His field of view was even smaller, the bottom half being occluded by webbing. At first he saw a blurred, spinning field of black, but Strathyla took an awkward step back, allowing Tyler to see more of her. He could see that she was walking badly because she was missing a leg, and that she had abandoned him to instead fight off the person who had cost her that leg. Jimmy. Jimmy yelled and cursed and whooped at the giant spider, obviously attempting to draw its attention. One would have thought that Strathyla's severed leg lying at Jimmy's feet would be enough, but Jimmy wasn't taking any chances. Jimmy poked toward Strathyla's face with his sword, while lunging backward like a man in his 60s imitating an Olympic fencer, which is exactly who Jimmy was and what he was doing. The smaller spiders that had chased Jimmy up the tree were now streaming in to surround him. Jimmy suspected they wouldn't attack him now that he had Strathyla's attention. She seemed to take precedent. Jimmy saw the spiders closing in around him, took one last mad swipe at Strathyla, damaging the lowest joint on her front right leg, and took off sprinting in the one direction that wasn't quite closed off by arachnids. He had almost waited too long. As it was, he had to leap between a few blank patches of ground, like a child on a patterned carpet, trying to avoid stepping in the red-hot lava. Jimmy peeked back over his shoulder just long enough to see that the massive spider was following him. Now he just had to think of something to do with it. As if on cue, Philip shouted, "Bring it here!" Philip had seen Jimmy's dismount from the tree. It gave him an idea. The spiders were maintaining a given distance from him. What if he moved? More to the point, what if he moved to the corner of the roof? On flat ground, he could never leap over the spiders. There were just too many. If he could get to the corner of the cottage, though, half the spiders would be clinging to the side, like Jimmy's spiders had been clinging to the tree. Then he might be able to jump off the building to the clean ground below. Then he would probably sprain his ankle, fall to the ground, and be surrounded by the spiders again. But it was something to do, and if he managed not to injure himself, he could help save Tyler. It hadn't come to that. By the time Philip worked this out and made his way to the edge, pausing a couple of times to fight off the attacking single-file spiders, Jimmy had taken one of Strathyla's legs, and now she planned to take Jimmy's life. Philip got Jimmy's attention, and Jimmy ran straight toward Philip's position. Philip glanced at Gary. What he saw was more encouraging than he'd hoped. Gary had clearly watched Philip and understood what he was doing. Gary was standing at the front edge of the roof he'd claimed, and nodded when he saw Philip look his way. Jimmy led Strathyla directly beneath Philip's perch, followed by a black wave of spiders. Now that their mom was injured, they were all attempting to help her, or kill Jimmy. Either way, they were leaving Tyler alone. Philip watched the spiders approach carefully. It was having a great deal of difficulty walking straight. Jimmy had cut off the lower two-thirds of one of its right legs and had injured one joint on another. Philip pictured his trajectory in his mind's eye, adjusted his grip on his sword, holding it like a small oar. Then, when the moment was right, he acted. Philip didn't leap so much as fall feet first while spinning 180 degrees. He landed on his rear, just to the right of the spider's center, with his feet extending down between Strathyla's right third and right rear legs. As he slid down the spider's side, his sword, driven by his momentum, pushed one of Strathyla's remaining right legs into Philip, then, with a little effort, sheared it off. Philip fell to the ground, rolling to absorb the force. The leg flopped forward and tangled with the two remaining working legs on that side. Strathyla's substantial weight was now supported unevenly by her four functioning legs on one side and one and a half legs on the other. She staggered and spun in a panic. Philip crawled and scrambled through the forest of lurching legs, emerging to stand next to Jimmy. Now, together, they yelled and cursed and jabbed at the spider with their swords while the sea of smaller spiders advanced. Then they took off running, Strathyla chasing them as best she could. Her difficulty in turning to the left made leading her in front of Gary's shed a bit difficult, but they managed it. Gary considered trying to impale and kill the spider outright in one blow, but decided it was too risky when they already had a plan that was working. Instead, he again followed Philip's lead, bouncing off the spider's back before falling to the ground, followed by the spider's last fully intact right leg, then the spider itself. The right side of Strathyla's body rested on the ground, her four pristine left legs struggling to lift her, and her one damaged front leg lamely scratching at the ground, unable to even come close to supporting half her weight. Gary looked to Philip and Jimmy and asked, "You got this?" Then he sprinted to go de-web Tyler before Philip was done saying, "Yeah." Tyler's instructions to attack at the leg joints had worked out pretty well, so Philip and Jimmy followed his second directive, to go for the eyes as another weak point. It was a grisly but effective technique. It wasn't long before Strathyla stopped thrashing and started twitching. The smaller spiders had followed the action in an orderly manner and kept their distance during the battle with Strathyla. But the instant she seemed to die, they flew into some sort of blind panic. They chittered. They ran in circles. They climbed over one another, piling up to 4 spiders deep in places. They didn't attack Philip or Jimmy. The men were like 2 bewildered palm trees on an island amid a violent sea. Then, all at once, the smaller spiders stopped moving, chittering, or even holding their bodies off the ground. They all fell, as a unit, silently to the ground. Philip gently poked at one of the small spiders with his foot. The spider's limp legs drug behind as Philip's boot pushed its torso along the ground. It was like kicking an extremely disturbing stuffed animal. Philip said,
"It's dead."
Tyler said,
"Not dead enough."
Gary had cut him free, and he was unharmed physically, but he seemed shaken. He'd probably have spider-themed nightmares for years to come, but that was a problem for later. Gary said,
"You ever see a horror movie where the monster was dead the first time it looked dead? No, the spider's not dead yet. It's still got at least 1 more round in it."
Jimmy looked at Strathyla's face, slack and lifeless, with the handles of his and Philip's swords protruding from her eyes like binoculars.
"I don't know," he said. "Looks pretty dead to me."
Tyler said,
"Gary's right. It doesn't matter. Try this. You 2 killed her, right? Philip, you announce that she's dead. Then you and Jimmy turn your back and start to walk away."
Philip shrugged and said,
"She is dead!"
He and Jimmy theatrically turned their backs to the hulking corpse and started walking away, through the sea of foot-sized spiders. Jimmy patted Philip on the back and said,
"Good job killing that thing."
Philip replied,
"Nice touch."
The spiders through which they were wading suddenly started moving, parting around their feet, leaving the customary clear zone around the 2. Behind them they heard a low, rasping noise, and then the sound of giant spider feet scraping and clawing at the ground. They turned and saw that, as Tyler had predicted, Strathyla was still alive and madder than ever. Of course, she was still missing 3.5 legs, and both of her eyes were out of commission as well, so she could do little more than thrash around and sound angry. But still, it was unnerving. Jimmy said,
"Oh, let me get that."
He stepped forward, grabbed the handle of his sword, which was protruding from Strathyla's left eye, and twisted it clockwise, 90 degrees. Strathyla fell limp, as if Jimmy's sword were an off switch, which, in a sense, it was. The smaller spiders again fell dead, but this time, instead of just lying there, they slowly faded from view. Jimmy and Philip pulled their swords from Strathyla's head, then watched as the giant spider's remains slowly dissolved away, leaving behind nothing but an immense, spider-shaped skeleton. Gary said,
"Okay, yeah, now it's dead enough."
"Take a good look, guys," Tyler said. "We're the first people in history to ever see a spider's skeleton, because they don't exist. Hear that, Todd?"
Strathyla's legs were recognizable. Her skull was essentially a smaller, whiter version of her original head. The central mass of her body, where her legs had been connected, was a tangle of small, stout bones, just complex enough to be bewildering, but far too simple to actually function. Her abdomen, which on spiders is a large, bulbous appendage behind the legs, was a hollow, round cage of gracefully curving bones.
"Why are her ribs where her butt should be?"
Gary asked.
"Because Todd's an idiot,"
Tyler answered. On the skeleton's back, at the center of where the legs were connected, 1 bone stood out from all the others. It didn't seem to be attached to the other bones, or to serve any structural purpose. Also, it was glowing. Gary pointed to the bone and said,
"Tyler, would you like to do the honors?"
Tyler scowled and said,
"Just get it over with."
Tyler turned and walked toward the blacksmith shop. Gary pulled the bone from Strathyla's back, and the rest of her skeleton faded away into nothingness. They followed Tyler to the shop. Once there, they decided to give it to Inchgower right away, for fear that if they didn't, two Strathylas might regenerate. The blacksmith took the bone. Suddenly, every artificial villager in town was there, celebrating with the exact same celebratory song and dance the miners had used when they got their bird back. The villagers built a bonfire and made food. Surprisingly, Inchgower threw Strathyla's bone into the fire. Philip, Gary, and Jimmy mostly sat and watched the artificial people enjoy their artificial celebration. Tyler excused himself and went to sit alone for a while and think. That night they put down their bedrolls on Inchgower's floor, as they had before. When the wizards woke up, they were delighted to see Inchgower standing next to the heavy ball of Dailuine ore.
"Thank God," Philip thought. "After all that manual labor and spider fighting, now he'll actually get on to making the weapon, whatever it is."
As the wizards got up from their bedrolls, Philip felt an unfamiliar jabbing sensation from the pocket of his jeans. He put his hand in, and by touch alone, he instantly recognized that there was a ballpoint pen in his pocket. It had not been there when he went to bed. Philip surreptitiously pulled out the pen and found a sheet of paper, a page torn from a small notepad, wrapped around the barrel of the pen. Keeping the pen concealed, he made a quick visual survey of the room. Inchgower was standing almost motionless, as was his custom. Jimmy and Gary were rolling up their bedding. Tyler was also putting away his bedding, but he was looking at Philip as he did it. His manner was so aggressively nonchalant that it couldn't help but get Philip's attention. Philip and Tyler's eyes locked. Tyler glanced quickly toward Philip's pocket. Philip nodded, then moved his right hand in such a way as to demonstrate that he was concealing the pen. Tyler immediately turned his attention to his bedding as if nothing had happened. In the process of rolling up his own bedding, Philip found a means of concealing and reading the note Tyler had passed. It said,
"Todd is probably watching and listening. After we make the weapon, next stop is Chasm of Certain Doom. We need a plan. T."
Philip knew that Tyler was right on all counts, but he didn't have the foggiest idea what to do about it. Inchgower directed the wizards to remove the chunk of rock from the sledge and bring it into the shop. The rock was heavy enough that one man could carry it with great difficulty, two could move it with some exertion, and three or more could move it with little effort and a great deal of bickering. When they got the Dailuine into the shop, Inchgower told them to place it on the floor. He turned his back to the wizards and started rummaging around his tools.
"All right," Gary said. "Now's when things start to happen."
Inchgower turned and started handing the wizards hammers and chisels.
"Yes," Philip said. "Things are happening. Terrible things."
Inchgower pointed to the Dailuine and said,
"Now, you break the ore into chunks about an inch square. You see, once I've worked the Dailuine, it'll be one of the hardest materials known to man. But in its natural state, it's not as tough."
Philip knelt down next to the gray chunk of rock. He placed the sharp edge of the chisel on the rock's surface, carefully aimed his hammer blow, and brought the hammer down with all of his might on the chisel. He felt a painful jolt of force run through the bones of his hand and arm. The rebounding hammer nearly hit him in the face. He examined the spot where his chisel had bit into the rock. He could barely make out a scratch. Inchgower continued,
"Of course, it's one of the toughest forms of raw ore in the world as well, but not quite as strong as it will be when it's worked."
The four of them pounded the rock like prisoners in a cartoon from the 1950s. After most of a day of hammering and chiseling, and cursing Todd's name, the Dailuine was finally reduced to large bore rubble. Inchgower gathered the rubble and put it in the pot he had made the day before, which had now hardened. He threw in the burnt spider bone, which crumbled like a dirt clod in his hands. He instructed the wizards to lay down two bricks in the middle of the floor of the brick cube. While they did that, he put a few more items into the pot: an unidentifiable powder, and a piece of broken glass. He placed the lid on the pot and put the pot inside the cube. As the wizard stood, watching Inchgower do the work for a change, Tyler felt something touch one of his hands. He nearly looked down, but then he recognized the sensation as that of a pen being placed in his hand. He took the pen, noted that it had paper rolled around it, and then carefully slid the whole thing into his pocket. After a five count, he ventured a surreptitious glance at Philip, who nodded. Soon it was time to get back to work. While Inchgower supervised via his usual method, standing silently and pointing, the wizards packed the rest of the charcoal into the cube. When the pot was completely buried, the remaining bricks were used to put a domed roof on the structure, and the remaining clay was packed in around the bricks for insulation. Again, they chose to rest for a bit before they covered the last brick with clay, which would cause Inchgower to issue more commands. They sat for a moment and looked at what they'd made.
"Man," Gary said, "that is some kind of ugly."
He wasn't wrong. The unevenness of their amateur bricklaying was not helped by the thick coating of lumpy clay they'd heaped inexpertly on its surface.
"It doesn't have to be pretty," Tyler said. "It just has to be hot. It's a furnace. The charcoal will burn and the bricks will trap and intensify the heat and melt the ore."
"Makes sense," Philip said.
"What was the deal with the spider bone and the glass?"
Tyler said, "I don't know about the glass, but the bones were to add carbon. There was a time that sword makers would use the bones of their enemies. They thought it would imbue the finished sword with the fallen warrior's might."
Gary said, "So whatever he makes us, it'll have the might of a spider."
"A fake spider," Tyler corrected him.
"But it seemed to work. The carbon made the finished weapon harder. They just thought it was magic."
"How do you know this stuff?" Gary asked.
"Research. I write fantasy novels. You need to know this kind of stuff. Besides, this is the easiest possible thing to research. Anyone who's been to Colonial Williamsburg or watched PBS on a lazy Saturday afternoon has been told this. Todd and I just took notes. I just hope he didn't take notes too well."
Jimmy asked,
"Why? What happens next?"
"He lights the charcoal and it burns for hours while it melts the rocks."
"Sounds hot and boring," Jimmy said.
Tyler said,
"If we're lucky."
"What if we're not lucky?"
Tyler stood up and said,
"Let's see."
He scooped up a handful of clay and slapped it onto the last corner of exposed brick. Inchgower said,
"Well done, lads. Now, I'll light the fire. And as the charcoal burns down, the ore will melt and change into pure, hardened diluine."
Gary nodded and mumbled,
okay.
Tyler muttered,
"Wait for it."
Inchgower turned to his tool rack, rummaged for a moment, and turned back to them with four large, hand-operated bellows in his arms.
"And you will use these to pump air into the fire, making it burn hot enough to melt the metal."
Tyler said,
"Yep, that's what I was afraid of."
"Yes, all four of you,"
Inchgower beamed, answering a question Todd had expected them to ask. Tyler said,
"The oxygen, it intensifies the fire."
Inchgower answered a second anticipated but unasked question.
"Yes, the entire time."
Tyler said,
"I think they usually have people alternate pumping. That way no one person gets totally exhausted. Everyone stays just exhausted enough."
Inchgower said,
"About 6 hours.
Answering a question nobody had asked because they feared the answer. Tyler turned to Jimmy and said,
"If it's any consolation, it'll be hot and boring. So you weren't wrong."
19. Everyone agreed that the task of lugging a heavy chunk of rock would not be made easier by having the rock in question also be invisible. Luckily, Britt solved the problem by wrapping it in Martin's silver-sequined wizard robe. Now, instead of looking like empty space, the ore looked like a poorly made disco ball. The problem of the Diluine's invisibility was solved easily. The problem of the sledge's invisibility was left unsolved, because they never even knew it had existed. Nobody had ever offered Philip's party the use of the sledge. They just saw it and chose to use it. Nobody offered